unless we see a move from 100,000 to 250,000 or 300,000 or 500,000 in fairly short order, we're just not going to build up enough leverage in the system to create a washout that will drive us down 70-80%.
We could see the price top out at 125. I don't think that's the case, but we could see it go to 500,000 or beyond. Who knows what's going to happen, but it's an interesting time to be alive, that's for sure.
Ultimately, this is game theory. If the US government does want to buy some Bitcoin, they shouldn't be telling everyone when they do until they do. We've had plenty of chance to front run the US government.
Bitcoin is continuing to be integrated into multiple new aspects of everyday life, and the more it integrates into these things, the harder and harder it is to extract it. If you attack Bitcoin, you are attacking the natural incentives that other people have to protect it. And the more that Bitcoin is embedded into people's infrastructure and their day-to-day lives, it becomes so much harder to actually extract it from that system.
Welcome back to another Roundup episode. Today, we're going to be talking about a variety of topics. The first and maybe most pressing thing for a lot of Bitcoiners is the fact that we hit a new all-time high last week, and then this week, we are certainly not there anymore. The question is, what happened and what does this mean? Is the bull run over? People are concerned. I don't think you guys are probably too concerned, but what are your thoughts on the Bitcoin all-time high followed by this relative crash?
Yeah, I think, you know, Bitcoin was kind of doing what it's expected to do, which is go up and make new all-time highs every once in a while. And, you know, it kind of been just consolidating for a little bit and looked like it was going higher and started breaking out. And I was watching the price and thinking to myself, like, I don't know, something doesn't seem right. Like, this is not really reaching escape velocity yet. It just seemed like it was moving a little too slow after it reached into those new heights. And sure enough, somebody came in and sold a bunch. I think the primary kind of driver of that, if you're looking for one, was the inflation information that came out that day that basically showed that inflation was much hotter than people were anticipating, at least on the producer price index perspective, which you would expect to feed into the consumer price index as well a little bit down the line. And that is one of the key metrics that the Fed is using to make their decision on rates and rate cuts and that kind of thing. And so, you know, if inflation is running hotter, then you would expect that the Fed is going to be a little bit more more hawkish when it comes to their you know, rate decisions and that kind of thing. And I think the market was just pricing in that possibility. Since we've sold off, that was a pretty big red candle there. And we've kind of just been drifting lower a little bit, kind of slowly. Like, it hasn't really accelerated. There's a little bit of a bid that looks like it came in today as well. So, I think this is very normal for what we've seen over the course of this bull market so far, which is that all dips are bought. There's so many buyers in the market there, just kind of sitting underneath the market, sitting on the bid, and just scooping up coins whenever they come on a little bit of a discount. So I know I was buying a little bit of this dip, and I think the Bitcoin treasury companies are out there buying this dip. And we're going to continue to see these buyers come in force when there's any kind of drawdown in the price. And if that actually is the case, then, you know, it might take some time to work through whatever selling pressure came in. But ultimately, this thing should resolve higher and we'll continue the march upward.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's really been a steady up and to the right. If you look over the last 2 years, especially from the summer of 2023, and I think now we're approaching that year and a half post halving coming up here in October of 2025, that we tend to see the peak of a bull run. But I think now, as we're approaching around 95% of supply of Bitcoin already issued, we may be seeing that the new issuance of Bitcoin having less of an effect on the overall price action, and having, as you mentioned, more of a steady bid, bigger buyers, institutional buyers that aren't going to let the price fall even 30, 40, or 50% because they're going to buy that dip quicker, knowing that we've continued to head towards all-time high. So as much as we love to see more open water Bitcoin, I think, when you hit that about 125K coming back down, I certainly expect to see us testing well above that. So when the relative crash or dip is to the mid 110Ks, you know, we're in a good spot compared, you know, for a new year over the years. But I think definitely an entry point, you know, is never a bad time to get in to Bitcoin and start saving in Bitcoin. So that as we continue to progress, I just think we're going to see more of that. But certainly the liquidity engines, spigots haven't been fully turned on yet, right? There's been the call for it, lowering interest rates, but very much still elevated rate environment here in the U.S.
So a quick pulse check. I'm curious to know if you guys at this point in time think that we're still going to be lined up with the 4-year cycles. I mean, some people are calling for a September high followed by the bear market. Or would you subscribe more to the extended cycle? I was just listening to Tur Demeester on a report that Unchained actually put out. And he was saying that he thinks we're probably seeing some extended cycles and that 2021 was cut a little bit short last time, but we would have seen that trend. Or do you feel like we're not really at that point where we're going to have a very easily identifiable cycle anymore?
Yeah, the cycle's not dead yet. If we are still just in this kind of chop solidation through the end of this year and going into next year, then, you know, maybe that argument holds more water. But I tend to agree with Tur that, you know, it might be a little bit extended from past cycles, just given the way that the price action has happened and given the new players that are in the market, these institutional players and the more fulsome derivative markets that are out there and the ETFs and the options markets on the ETFs and Bitcoin treasury companies and all of this. So the market dynamic is definitely different, but I'm still not convinced that we don't at some point hit escape velocity on this price that brings in retail in a much more forceful way and just more broadly buyers that are price indiscriminate because they just have FOMO. Mm-hmm. And whenever that happens, leverage builds up and you get these massive price increase. And I still maintain that we won't see these huge drawdowns without a corresponding price increase at the beginning of that. So unless we see a move from 100,000 to 250,000 or 300,000 or 500,000 in fairly short order, like we have in the past, we're just not going to build up enough leverage in the system to create a washout that will drive us down 70-80%. So I'm the more time goes on in this type of environment, especially given the tailwinds of the macro economy and the debt and the money printing that is on the horizon, the more I feel confident that this is just extended cycle. We're going to extend and stair step higher until at some point you just go past the event horizon where the black hole above starts sucking the price higher.
Sure, higher John, price. What do you think?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think we're still living in the cycle, but it is likely going to be extended, I think, into 2026 or until whenever the Fed chair, you get a new Fed chair in, that's going to play ball a bit more with the agenda that Trump and Bessent want to have with lowering 10 and 30 year yields ultimately, which are a little bit out of their grasp, but they can, of course, adjust the Fed fund rates down and let the liquidity flow a bit more and really play towards the growth angle. And that's that value, that money is just going to flow into harder assets. And we know Bitcoin is the hardest asset. And at this point now, as an inflation rate, even less than gold. And we did see a bit of a spike there in gold when there was a little bit of a tariff scare with the bars coming out of Switzerland. And I think a little bit of a preview too. So as much as Bitcoin continues to be recognized as digital gold, and even well beyond that, and being a very strong medium of exchange compared to gold, which is not, and very much prone to centralization and censorship. I think just the narrative and the drumbeats will continue to get louder, and we'll continue to have a distribution of Bitcoin through the mining process, of course, still 450 Bitcoin a day. So still a solid amount of Bitcoin that is being absorbed by the market. But you're gonna have these sellers, as you have maybe mini tops, taking some off the table, or for whatever reason, as we saw here in the mid 120s, maybe some sell-off happening. But until the MVRV is a great ratio, I think, to look at, the market value versus realized value of the last time the Bitcoin changed hands. And as long as we're still in like the 2-ish range or not at the 4, 5, 6 range, that's when markets really get overheated. We'll have a good evidence on when that is.
If you were hit by a bus right now, could your family access your Bitcoin? When's the right time to stop hodling and use Bitcoin to impact your family's lives, not just yours? What if Bitcoin doesn't reach the value you expect, or it takes longer to reach that value? Do you have a plan? Do you have the proper trust structure to avoid probate, maintain your privacy, and minimize taxes? Do you want to avoid taxes to stack more sats or leverage your stack without selling? Should you add Bitcoin to your business's balance sheet? Are you truly confident in your self-custody setup? If any of those questions made you stop and think, you probably realize that simply buying and holding Bitcoin is not a complete financial plan. That's where Strong Wealth comes in. Orange-pilled advisors blending traditional financial planning with deep Bitcoin expertise, giving you the best of both worlds, so you can sleep peacefully knowing you're making the right moves for your family no matter what happens. Schedule a free call at strongwealth.net. That's strongwealth.net. Strong Wealth, wealth management for Bitcoiners by Bitcoiners.
Yeah, imagine this scenario, right? We've gone from, call it 30 to 40,000 or wherever it was around the banking crisis back in 2023 with SVB, all the way up to 118,000. And we've now spent significant amount of time above 100,000, right? Like there's been, I saw over 100 trading days now where the price has been above 100,000. That starts to go into people's psyche, right? Like it's 100,000, six-figure Bitcoin has become normalized. And this is all with this overhang of a fairly hawkish Fed and fairly hawkish monetary policy that Chair Powell has pursued, keeping rates higher, not necessarily responding to weakness that other people are seeing in the economy. And with Trump trumpeting louder that Powell needs to go and that the replacement for him, whenever his term comes up in early next year, is going to be much more dovish. Now, all of a sudden, you're going to have a brand new tailwind coming into the market with much more liquidity. And so it seems pretty difficult to imagine that that's not going to affect the price of Bitcoin in anticipation of that and in early next year. So we really just need to kind of continue to grind through these next months if that's the market dynamic that we're going to see play out. And then all of a sudden you've got a brand new tailwind. But what could happen is that we start getting that acceleration in Q4, the way that the 4-year cycle typically plays out. And then they start easing even on top of that, right? It's like, could cause this kind of perfect storm. And in that scenario, the price is going to go very high. And there's going to be this leverage buildup that we're going to see, which is going to lead to a massive drawdown later, you know, maybe later next year or something like that. So that's a very possible scenario, I think, that we could see play out.
It's easy to want to see patterns and to follow those patterns. But I forget who it was that prognosticated back in the 90s about the end of history. And there may have been this time where things felt like not a whole lot was happening or would happen in the future. You know, there's enough peace and whatever else. But one thing's for sure, whether it's Bitcoin or just, you know, geopolitics, we're living in a very interesting time. And I would not assume at any point that, you know, past performance and would at all indicate what's going to happen in the future. We're living in a time where who knows what could happen. I mean, we could see the price top out at 125. I don't think that's the case, but we could see it go to 500,000 or beyond. Who knows what's going to happen, but it's an interesting time to be alive. That's for sure.
I mean, 125, like I find it very hard to believe that we're going to correct by 70% from the recent high of 124, 125, right? And so if we're saying, oh, the price has topped, what that would ultimately imply is that we're going to maybe chop around for the next 6 months or even a year or something in between the 100,000, you know, or maybe 80,000 to $125,000 range or whatever. Like that's going to really grind on people for sure, but it's not going to feel so disastrous as a 70% drawdown from 125 to bring you back down to like 30,000 or whatever, mm-hmm. right? Like that, I think, is not in the cards right now.
Now, I'm pretty sure we don't have major Bitcoin Strategic Reserve fans here on this discussion right here. But earlier in the week, about the same time that Bitcoin fell in price, Scott Bessent was on TV, and he seemed to indicate that there were really no plans to buy into the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve. He later walked that back on X. A lot of Bitcoiners seem to be suggesting that that was the reason that the Bitcoin price fell. Trey, you've already spoken to this a little bit. I feel like it's really easy for Bitcoiners to think that the world revolves around Bitcoin, and I don't think that's at all the case. I mean, there's a whole lot of red at the end of last week. But do you think that that was him misspeaking, or do you feel like it's just an indication of what we sort of had either feared or anticipated anyway, which is that the U.S. isn't going to be buying Bitcoin anytime soon?
I still don't think they will be buying Bitcoin anytime soon. I don't know that it was a misspeaking on his part, though. These kinds of things almost feel like trial balloons or something. Like, these are very measured people. They don't make these types of rhetorical mistakes very often, at least. I mean, it's possible that that's what this was. But it felt to me more like, okay, I'm just going to tell it kind of like it is and signal to the market that we're not going to be buying Bitcoin and see how things react. And then there must have been some other pressure that came in and told him to, no, you like got to walk that back, which also might have been a trial balloon. Like, you just kind of never know what kind of machinations are happening in the background. But I don't think that these things happen by accident. I feel like, you know, the way that the Fed manages things, the way that the Treasury manages things, the way that the government in large part manages things is through rhetoric and through you know, what they are focusing on and what they are talking about. And I just find it hard to believe that the Treasury Secretary, who is normally very on point and on top of things, is just, you know, talking out of the left side of his mouth when the right side of his mouth is thinking something else. Like, he's just making a huge mistake or something. I just don't see that as plausible. John, what do you think?
I think that's an interesting theory, and he definitely walked it back via X and tweeting later on and saying, hey, there are going to be budget neutral ways that we approach buying Bitcoin or getting more Bitcoin, and actually did give a number, I think, in that $10 to $15 billion range of how much Bitcoin the U.S. government actually still holds. So that's still very much an unknown of how much out of the 200,000 or so seized Bitcoin does the government actually still hold. Is it more in the 125-150K coin range and not all the way at 200? Then they need to keep the price down to potentially get back to the level the current administration thought they were at when they were coming in here and ultimately issuing the executive order that came in January to find budget neutral ways of buying Bitcoin. So I agree very much. I think testing maybe market reactions to that, and that revaluing of the gold, that's potentially a $1 trillion play that they could do, is also, I think, very much still on the table, as much as he said it's not either, right? I mean, the U.S. has had a history of revaluing gold, a couple of key points of basic default. And as they get more desperate to pay off the debt that we know is looming, they're going to look to resort to that. And I still think, yeah, Bitbonds is an amazing potential option that the government could look at in terms of, if you're going to issue some debt, include some Bitcoin in there and get some appreciation. And if we don't, if the government doesn't, well, then the deficit keeps running away and they have even more challenges. So I agree. I think Bessent's very measured and calculated. So I don't think it was necessarily a slip, maybe more of a testing of the reaction. But if ultimately this is game theory, if the U.S. government does want to buy some Bitcoin, they shouldn't be telling everyone when they do until they do, because you already have other countries buying it or companies or individuals that you've had plenty of chance to front run the U.S. government. Yeah, I think that certainly interesting timing was right around the PPI numbers coming out. So it's hard to tell, you know, maybe what sank the market price right at that moment, you know, on the Wednesday morning. But markets react quick to these announcements. and whether it's the Fed or now the Treasury getting out there and stating what they plan to do. And generally, the Fed has telegraphed things pretty far in advance now under this current Fed, but maybe that could change as well. So certainly an interesting experiment.
When was the executive order that established the SBR? When did that happen? And like, in my mind, it just, this was like 6 or 9 months ago. If they were going to buy Bitcoin with budget neutral ways, they've had time to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, like it only gets harder in my mind the longer this goes. And I know things move like a little bit slowly, but we're again talking about an executive order here. We're talking about the executive branch telling their employees, the people who work directly for them, what they should do. That hasn't happened yet. So it just, I'm just skeptical that even that piece of it is going to happen at this point.
Today's episode of Business Bitcoinization is proudly brought to you by Velus Commerce, where the future of business technology meets Bitcoin. As we journey through the era of Bitcoin and its transformational impact on businesses, there's one name that stands out: Velus Commerce. Whether you're looking to build a cutting-edge website, a seamless mobile app, or custom software, Velus is your go-to team. They've been diving deep into the world of Bitcoin since 2014, making them one of the most experienced groups for integrating Bitcoin and Lightning payments into a variety of digital platforms. But here's what truly sets them apart. Velus Commerce doesn't just build. They bring a wealth of knowledge to ensure your project success from day one. Their team understands the nuances of Bitcoin, ensuring that your business stays ahead of the curve. And for all business Bitcoinization listeners out there, Velus Commerce is offering a free consultation to kickstart your project the right way. So if you're ready to future-proof your business in the coming age of hyper-Bitcoinization, head over to veluscommerce.com or reach out on Twitter at veluscommerce. Let's make sure your business thrives in the Bitcoin era. It's a curious thing, and I don't know what's going to happen. I do think there will be more signaling before there's a major announcement. That said, you know, you're talking about Trey, just how at the upper echelons of society, especially, rhetoric matters a lot. Signaling matters a lot too. And Harvard has just announced that they've purchased $116 million of BlackRock's Bitcoin ETF. That's out of, you know, I think something like a $50 billion endowment. I may be off by an order of magnitude. I don't know. It's a ton of money. And so it's not that high of a percentage. But I think that type of signal is also really important. I remember years ago, I reached out to my alma mater, much smaller, not Ivy League, but I was trying to get them to think about buying Bitcoin. It was pre-ETFs. It probably seemed way too scary. But it's just one of those things that I think a lot of schools are going to be looking at what Harvard has done. And whether or not they agree with Harvard, Harvard is certainly a signal to them. So I'm very interested to see what schools do and what other institutions continue to do as, you know, states and institutions like Harvard are buying Bitcoin.
Yeah, the Harvard endowment is kind of a bellwether among university endowments, right? It's kind of famous. Harvard is kind of famous for having a very successful and very large foundation or endowment there. And so people do look to it as a signal for being able to justify other allocations that they might not otherwise make, right? If any other university endowment, the guys who are running that, guys and gals who are running that, are looking for an excuse to now get Bitcoin exposure, well, they have it. They can point to Harvard and not say we were the first, you know, and to say, look, if Harvard's doing it, it's good enough for us. And yeah, it's a very small allocation. That's typically how these things start. People need to wet their beak a little bit before everybody is comfortable with larger allocations. Who knows what type of allocation rule set they put in place. You know, a lot of times in these large allocators will put in a rule that says, we're not going to let this, you know, if it goes up by 3x, we're going to trim it down to, you know, 2% or whatever the thing is, right? And so that remains to be seen. But it is much more important that they are doing it as opposed to the size that they're doing it at. $100 million is not that big, but it's also, you know, it's not like they just bought one Bitcoin and said, let's see how this goes, you know?
Yeah, it depends on who you ask. $100 million is, you know, there are actually a lot of smaller schools that have size, you know, really built up endowments across the years. And, you know, they're right at that kind of $100 million level. So I'd be really interested to see if some of them might take some of that signaling and, you know, set aside $1 million or just, you know, 100,000, or it'll just be interesting to see what other schools do, how they interpret that signal and how much they want to hop in as well.
Yeah, I think it's a massive signal to the university space that has typically gotten a lot of government funding, right? And they've been supporting, and now there's been some threats to that government funding for universities. So if the ultimate purpose of the endowment is to ensure a very long time horizon for an institution, you need to look at preserving your capital. And Bitcoin is the best way to preserve your capital over the long term. So I think there actually wasn't enough new, and you didn't see a lot of news about it in the traditional coverage, I think, of this decision by Harvard. I think Brown also got into the mix as well. Certainly it's being covered in the Bitcoin circles, but not as much in TradFi. And so it's a huge signal. And I think the other institutions will have to follow their lead. Otherwise, they will be left behind. And as it has been getting more and more competitive for admissions and for, you know, fighting for talent, they're going to need to buy Bitcoin. And through the and there's some universities that have gotten in, you know, to education, such as with Nick Bhatia at USC, and there's others that are in the Bitcoin space, economists that are educating on Austrian economics and Bitcoin. But it's, Nick had said recently, it's like one in 30. And, you know, it's really an event we hosted him in Chicago, and it's in, among his peers, and I think in general, just amongst institutions, we're still that early in the low percentage points of Bitcoin adoption. So seeing Harvard take this leap, yeah, 100 million isn't anything to scoff at. It's bigger than, you know, the annual budget for probably many schools. And to take that big of a leap into Bitcoin, I think we should see more announcements, or at least institutions starting to have these conversations. We know they can be very bureaucratic, so it's probably going to take a little while, but it's moving the Overton window in that discussion point.
Yeah, it's also an important signal relative to just Harvard's view, or the endowment's view, of the viability of Bitcoin and its stance from a regulatory perspective and all that, right? Like 4 or 5 years ago, you wouldn't see them take this position, and they probably cite, the government's going to ban it, this and that, right? Nobody is really raising those concerns anymore. They're allocating to Bitcoin with the assumption that this now has the blessing of the government, and that they don't have, that's not an attack vector that they need to worry about. It's not a threat to their position. And so now they're just trying to figure out, okay, this is here to stay. It's, you know, there's either tacit support from the government, or at least they're getting out of the way of it. And now I can think about incorporating it into my asset allocation strategy. Mm-hmm.
Another exciting update this last week was Block announcing their new proto mining rig. And I don't keep up with the mining space all that much. So you two might know more than I do, especially about the implications here. But essentially it's a modular mining setup where something breaks, you change that part without having to replace the entire thing. And it seems like it's actually done in a very easy way, like not really many tools required. You can do it just in a few minutes or a few seconds. So it seems really interesting. And it also kind of brings some of the mining production, the production of the ASICs, back to the United States, at least the development. I'm actually not sure where Block is manufacturing these, but traditionally a lot of the ASICs have been developed and manufactured in Asia, probably primarily China. Have you followed this story, either of you, very much? And kind of what are your thoughts on how this influences the mining space?
Yeah, I think it's a huge play to see Block and Jack Dorsey continue to fuel open source development of not only on the software side and enabling merchant adoption of Bitcoin, but now on the mining side. I think it's a huge win. They're going to be running things Stratum V2 out of the box and just give way more modularity to those miners and keep more uptime, as really it's the most competitive market in the world to try to be a Bitcoin miner at scale. You have the ability yet to swap in different components if something is down and for repair, rather than needing to take the whole miner off the shelf to repair. And uptime is super important to ensure the profitability of a mine at scale. And I think one of the bigger threats to Bitcoin continues to be is always centralization. And in the mining space, and particularly mining pools, you see the bigger miners and collecting, wanting more regular collection of checks instead of the variability of winning a block. And you see even Foundry getting, I think last couple of days ago, like 8 blocks in a row, and you have some major pools centralization that this can help push back against maybe any complacency in that part of the industry. You know, Parker Lewis launched a new podcast, Center of Hash, to talk about a lot of this stuff. Recommend people to tune in to that. But I think bringing, you mentioned China as well, between Bitmain and Antminer coming out of the similar kind of houses there, being able to develop and build more of the technology here in the US is a massive win. So exciting to see way more efficient miners, more options coming to the market.
Yeah, I don't really have a whole lot to add other than I'm happy to see American-made manufacturing relative to mining hardware, you know, just given the fact that that historically has been totally dominated by China. And, you know, any new developments in that space are welcome for sure. I love the Stratum V2 integration there as well to kind of help to battle any potential threats to decentralization on the mining front. And yeah, we need more entrants in this space. We need more people thinking about Bitcoin mining and seeing it as an opportunity. And, you know, it's just another more evidence of Bitcoin's incentive structure at play as people, you know, come into space and try to develop things to help build it out in a much more robust way.
So, Trey, one final thing before we finish up today. You had brought this to my attention. The Fed has ended their novel activity supervision program. I thought this or something like it had already been done. You know, I did a little bit of reading up on it. It's just kind of officially happened. Am I confusing this with another story, or was there some sort of legislative action that had happened? Had this been announced that it would be ending, or is this totally kind of out of the blue?
Well, the Fed doesn't just control interest rates. They have a very strong regulatory function as well across the banking system. And essentially what this is saying is that they're removing this kind of extracurricular framework for evaluating banks relative to Bitcoin and crypto that they had put in place from the prior administration. So I think it's just a legacy framework built from the days of Choke Point 2.0 that has been officially discarded from the Fed. So the normal activity of regulating that they're doing, Bitcoin now fits within that framework as opposed to having some kind of special carve out there. And what it ultimately means, I think, is just that it's another indication that banks are being given the green light to build tooling, to connect into the Bitcoin network, to offer services that are using Bitcoin, built on Bitcoin, or, you know, otherwise just incorporating Bitcoin and, you know, its use as store value or collateral or whatever they will be building. It just gives them the green light to go forward with some of those efforts.
John, any thoughts on this? I don't know how much you've been keeping up with this. It's a little bit not out of my wheelhouse, but it's not a story that I followed.
Yeah, I think it's still just remnants of Choke Point 2.0 and a lot of an anti-regulatory stance along for Bitcoin or digital assets in general. So any of these sort of regulations that were in place or safeguards that were put around any banks, trusts wanting to interact with Bitcoin going away, I think these were the types of things happening a little more behind the scenes that were harder to really know until you were wanting to build a business that was connecting to Bitcoin rails with, you know, alongside the fiat rails. So certainly a positive development to see some of these, you know, I think discriminatory acts really against the money that is open source and anybody can tap into the Bitcoin network and enable more innovation to take place here in America.
Yep. The just larger theme across all of these different stories is that Bitcoin is continuing to be integrated into multiple new aspects of everyday life and business and industry and infrastructure. And the more it integrates into these things, the harder and harder it is to extract it. And so, like you if you attack Bitcoin, you are attacking the natural incentives that other people have to protect it. And the more that Bitcoin is embedded into people's infrastructure and their day-to-day lives as a savings vehicle in their 401ks, as you know, a product that the banks are offering for their customers, you know, on and on, becomes so much harder to actually extract it from that system. And so we just continue to see it become embedded into everyday life and become normalized as part of something that is just, it's just something that people do, right? Bitcoin is just, it's here to stay. It's something that everybody now knows about and more people are integrated with.
The path is being cleared for Bitcoin adoption. I think a lot of people who are in it on a day-to-day basis can be frustrated by the short-term price movements, but anyone who's been around long enough knows that it's going up over time. So my encouragement to anyone who is listening to this is stay the path. Things are going to be easier in the future for Bitcoin than ever, but it's never easy in the day-to-day to hodl. So just stay strong and stick out this bull market, as difficult as it may seem in the short term. John, can we hear from you about where people can go to keep up with what you're doing? And then Trey will finish up with you.
Yeah, feel free to reach out at the Bitcoin Yogi on X or Noster. You can check out my consulting work helping businesses integrate Bitcoin at satoshihealth.com. And then we're launching a Bitcoin health savings account vehicle at soundhsa.com. You can check that out. Actually, I have an event coming up at the space in Denver on Sunday. We'll be live streaming that to X as well, all about the connection of sound money and sound health, hearing from some doctors and other entrepreneurs who are integrating Bitcoin into their day-to-day. So happy to connect with you all there.
All right, and you can find me at TS_HODL on X, and go check out my newsletter on financial independence and Bitcoin. It is firebtc.substack.com. Appreciate you having me.
Yep, we'll talk to you guys in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, cheers.
Well, friends, it's a wrap. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Bitcoin Playbook. If you want to reach out to either me, Trey, or John, you can find those links down in the show notes. Be sure to check out Sound HSA and the Fire BTC Substack. As always, keep building, keep growing. Until next time, keep living and leading well.